Welcome again to the hall, to our practice home for the week. And I have the honor tonight to introduce what the topic for our practice together this week is going to be. Are you on the edge of your seats yet? Wondering, curious? Okay. Pausing for suspense. So, the topic for the theme for the retreat is equanimity. So this week we will be exploring, we'll be practicing together different aspects of equanimity, equipoise, and I want to say that I'm very excited about equanimity, which might seem like an oxymoron, to be excited about equanimity. As I'll be practicing with all of you, and just to share, to earlier today, I wasn't feeling so well, so I was lying on my bed and contemplating 1001 errands that had to be run, and the suitcase that wasn't yet packed and had to get packed, and I was just lying and feeling the lack of energy, and then my mind turned to the topic of equanimity that we'd be practicing together, and an embodied feeling of equanimity, just resting in equanimity. So I was lying, I was breathing, and a sense of peace, ease, joy, happiness overcame me, just thinking about equanimity and practicing in equanimity. That was both energizing, happy-making. And in many ways, it's not so much of a surprise, because equanimity shows up on many, many different lists and different ways that we'll explore this week with you, some of the ways that equanimity can be practiced and shows up on the different Buddhist lists. But one list that it shows up, one practice as it shows up on, is the practice of the Brahma Viharas, the four heavenly abodes, the four practices being metta, loving kindness, compassion, as well as vicarious joy, and equanimity being the fourth one. So it is related to these beautiful heart qualities, these happy, loving heart qualities. So part of what I was feeling today, practicing with today, both a sense of equipoise, embodied feeling of resting and feeling sense of calm, ease, peace. Equanimity was also relating to the Brahma Viharas, this warmth, happiness that comes from practicing equanimity. So I share my personal experience to hopefully inspire you and also make you excited about practicing this beautiful practice of equanimity together, exploring it in our practice together. I've often heard Gil call equanimity the crown jewel of Buddhist practice. I love that. It is a crown jewel. So this week we'll be practicing, we'll be exploring, not just in a heady way, equanimity, what is it, but really in an embodied way. What does equanimity feel like as a practice, as an embodied practice? So having said the word so many times, I do want to offer some definitions And again, we'll be talking and offering so many different ways throughout the week to relate to the word equanimity and upekkha in Pali. So this is just the beginning. You'll hear it so many ways as the two of us will talk about it back and forth. And when you're ready, it will land in different ways for you throughout the week. So equanimity, the word in English, comes from Latin, equanimitas, which means having an even mind, a state of psychological stability and composure, which is undisturbed by that which may cause others to lose the balance of their mind. Says, I forget if this was from Wikipedia or from dictionary, but I'll read it again. Let it wash over you. Equanimity, a state of psychological stability and composure, which is undisturbed by that which may cause others to lose the balance of their mind. What a beautiful quality to nurture. There are also many synonyms for it. Calmness, aplomb, collectedness, composedness, composure, equilibrium, imperturbability, placidity, repose, self-composedness, tranquility, serenity, equanimity. And the antonyms, perturbation, easier to say, perturbation, discomposure, agitation. And this idea, this practice of equanimity, it is a crown jewel in Buddhism, and it also shows up in many other practices in many other cultures. So Buddhism does not have hegemony over this practice because it's a human birthright, really, that many, many different traditions talk about it. And some time ago when I was giving a talk on equanimity and I was doing research and looked up in Wikipedia and other places about, actually this one was in Wikipedia, to see different traditions, I found a wonderful quote here about equanimity in Buddhism from, guess who? Gail Fronsdell. And the quote goes, "Equanimity is one of the most sublime emotions of Buddhist practice. It is the ground for wisdom and freedom and the protector of compassion and love. While some may think of equanimity as dry neutrality or cool aloofness, mature equanimity produces a radiance and warmth of being. The Buddha described a mind filled with equanimity as abundant, exalted, immeasurable, and without hostility and ill will." Lovely. To consider that this week we would be cultivating a mind that is filled with equanimity, that is abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. Ah. Equanimity shows up on many different lists. It shows up on the seven factors of enlightenment. We'll talk more about that later in the week. As I mentioned, is part of the four Brahmaviharas, the beautiful qualities of the heart, the practices of the heart, together with loving kindness and compassion and vicarious joy. We'll talk more about that, how it relates, how it supports, how in some ways it's one and the same, actually. We will talk about its near enemies, far enemies, that it's not aloofness. It's quite warm. It's engaged. It also relates to deep states of samadhi, samatha, concentration of the mind being collected in uniform. Equanimity is a factor, is a jhanic factor, which we'll talk about later also in the week. Also, there is another aspect of equanimity that shows up on the path to awakening. Equanimity towards all formations, one of the steps on the path to letting go, to complete letting go, which we'll talk about more also. In fact, there are, it's said, it is written in the Visuddhimagga, the path of purification, which is a practice manual about 1,000 pages from 5th century by Buddhaghosa. So it is said that there are 10 different types of equanimity. So plenty to explore and practice with and discover. And really not open our minds, but really mostly what I want to get across is to open our hearts to the embodiment of equanimity as a way to practice with all phenomena, with everything that arises in our sphere of experience, to support both arising of wisdom as well as love and compassion. So much to say, and I think in the way of introduction, this is enough for now. Thank you.
So for those of you who are new here to the retreat, every morning at 8:30 we'll give instructions, and it's nice if you can be here on time for that. We really like that, so we can get started. And then we'll give instructions for walking meditation at the end of that sitting. And then later in the morning, we'll talk about this again tomorrow, there'll be some instructions in meditation posture. And if you've never had that instruction, I encourage you to stay for that. So there'll be things that be to support you through the day tomorrow if you're brand new here. So there's a teacher who said that equanimity is the peaceful center of the world. And when Buddhist teachers talk about the world, they kind of mean the world that begins with you. So for your world that you sit in the middle of, however big and wide you think the world is, you're kind of at the center of it. And at the center of you, this teacher was suggesting, there's a peaceful place. And equanimity is to stand in that place, or see the world through the eyes of that place, or be connected to that a peaceful place, peaceful center. And it was lovely to have Nikki talk about all those synonyms for equanimity. And so different of ones of you will have different words that resonate. But there is a capacity for peace, for equanimity, for freedom, for compassion, for love, that lives in the center of us. And part of this practice, or a big part of it, center of the practice, is to stay true to that, or come in touch with that, or live that, have it become, embody that for ourselves. And in doing that, we go through layers and layers of the ways that we're not at the center, layers and layers of ways in which we are agitated, reactive, defended, caught up, afraid, angry, all kinds of things. And to sit and with all the layers, both the beautiful layers and the difficult layers, it's all here to be included as part of the practice. But it's a very tender thing to do. It's a very personal thing to do, and challenging thing to do as well. Very worthwhile to do. And as we do this work, it's very important to be supported, or know you're supported by all kinds of things. And at the opening of a retreat, we evoke two general categories of support that exist. And it exists partly because you make it exist, and because it also exists around you. And the first is the refuges. The Buddha, Dharma, the Sangha as the important supports for us. And then the five precepts, living an ethical life, that's also support. And these two things make it a lot easier to drop in, be present for that which is difficult and that which is wonderful that's here. You are supported. You're not alone in all this. And there's something about going for refuge and the precepts which suggests that it's not only up to your own efforts what's happening here. You don't have to figure out everything. That if you can remember that there's this, you know, or to have faith in that you're being supported by something that's bigger than yourself. And the Dharma knows what you need more than you do. So if you're caught up in this idea of you have to fix it, you have to make it work, you have to, you know, be successful or something, it doesn't quite work so smoothly. You end up with a lot of speed bumps then. But if you do your work and apply yourself the best you can, but also kind of open up and trust that you're also being reciprocally supported by much. And you're supported by the Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, but not simply because it's the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, because you go for refuge in it. It's going for refuge that's supportive. If you kind of just simply expect the Buddha to be your savior, and, you know, looking at your clock and waiting for when, you know, where's he coming? That doesn't work. But you have to offer something to it. You have to offer your trust or your entrustment or your faith or your confidence in this. You have to kind of understand, be willing to let this thing support you. And in that willingness, that openness, that's where the support really happens. So the refuges are three, the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. And it's said explicitly in the tradition from the early times that when we take refuge in the Buddha, it's not so much the person, the Buddha, but rather the his awakening. And we take refuge in his awakening as the capacity for the mind to certainly be equanimous, capacity of the mind to be free, capacity of the mind and heart to not be caught up, entangled, contracted, but rather the opposite, expanded, open, relaxed, fearless, that we have this capacity to be awake. And then when we take refuge in the Buddha, we're taking refuge in this wonderful capacity that lives in us, that maybe is not fully developed yet, but is there supporting our practice here. There's much more supporting you than, you know, than meets the eye, than what you're aware of. And so to go for refuge in the Buddha is to go offer your trust that there is awakening, there is freedom. You don't have to be stuck. To take refuge in the Dharma is to take refuge in, they say, the teachings of the Buddha. They're phenomenal teachings. I remain inspired by what I see in these ancient texts that's supposed to record the Buddha's teachings. But it's more than the teachings. The Dharma is the process of the path of liberation. The Dharma is the practices, the results of the practices, the insights. It's the engagement with the whole process of practice. And it's a mutual benefit, or it's a reciprocal thing. We offer ourselves to the practice, and the practice practices us. We do the practice with trust and faith in this practice, and the practice will do us. If we only thought it's up to us and our practice, we kind of shortchange ourselves, because the efforts you make to show up and be mindful, to be present, to be honest, to be kind, is a very powerful thing to do. And if you just stay, it's up to me, and I'll keep, you know, pumping out the kindness, the compassion, keep pumping out the mindfulness. There's no room. You make it kind of crowded. There's a way in which if you go for refuge, yes, you're going to practice, but you're also going to kind of open your hands really wide and just say, okay, I'm here also to receive back the goodness of that practice, the fruits of that practice. I'm here to allow the effects of that practice to move through me. I don't know what the effects are going to be, but I'm here also to receive that and to trust that that's worthwhile. At first, that trust might be borrowed trust because you haven't practiced enough. But with time, we get to learn that, oh, this is trustable. This is actually one of the most trustable things. I can't tell you how innumerable times, where I didn't know how to find my way with something, and I trusted the mindfulness. And somehow things opened up. Some things worked out. And really trust, to really go for refuge, as opposed to trusting or going for refuge in our anger or our fear or our, you know, there's all kinds of things that, or our problem-solving mind or our planning mind or our blaming mind, or there's all kinds of, a lot of people take refuge in those things in the sense that they invest so much meaning and importance in those kinds of things. But if we can invest importance and really put ourselves into the value of the practice and trust it, that's a trustable place. So when things get difficult, you know, take refuge in the Dharma. Taking refuge in the Sangha is very helpful to know that you're not alone in the practice. And I know that for myself, I couldn't have practiced as much as I have in my life if I didn't have other people around me to practice with, to be inspired by, to be supported by, to hold me up when it was difficult, to remind me, to hold me accountable, to challenge me, to irritate me, all kinds of things that, you know, I benefited from. I'm a better person because of it. I feel very, very grateful and inspired by the communities of people I've practiced with. And so to realize you're not alone and there's people here. There is a teaching kind of a little funny teaching about refuge with the Sangha. And that is that unless someone is really enlightened, you know, has a high degree of spiritual maturity, they might actually not be that reliable. You know, they're liable to kind of trip up and make mistakes or do things which they shouldn't really be doing or do things which are hurtful, you know, because they're still, you know, qualities of greed, hate, and delusion that might be lurking around in them. And so the teaching is that take refuge in the Sangha means really, really, some people say, means take refuge in the people who are enlightened because they're reliable. And so for me, I am quite inspired. It's very meaningful for me to meet people who are really mature in the practice and really show what's possible and the freedom that's possible. And in my lifetime, it supported me tremendously to encounter these people and, you know, get a sense of what's possible and know what's possible. But I don't want to diminish the value of even practicing with people who are going to make mistakes, the people who are not fully enlightened. And what I take refuge in there is the sincerity in which people are practicing. I take refuge in the fact that I kind of believe that everyone who practices is doing their best. Everyone is coming out of some deep sense of letting the goodness or the best in them to come forward and to have a chance to live in our life. And to be with a group of people who that's what they're trying to do, even if they make mistakes, I've learned to trust, partly because when you're with people who are practicing, more often than not, if there's problems, you can go talk about it. And a sangha is, I see a sangha as a place not that's with perfect people, but with a place where it's safe and appropriate to talk about it and to find our way as a community. And to take refuge in a sangha and be supported by that, to know that there's that kind of willingness and that kind of ability and sincerity has meant a world to me as I've practiced. And that also has really, there were times probably I wouldn't have kept practicing unless I had this kind of really experience and trust in the sincerity of the people who are around me. The incomplete sincerity, it doesn't have to be perfect, but that there's sincerity here, it's such an inspiring thing. So to take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha. And then the other thing that protects the practice, protects the refuges, makes it safer to have this willingness to be open and let these things kind of work through us and to open to what's here, is to live in a place where there's a basic safety. We cannot expect universal safety in all and every possible way. That's just, to expect that is to, you know, just make you more unsafe. But we can have the basic human safety. And so the safety that we offer here in the retreat that we all commit ourselves to is not to be cause physical harm to others, not to kill or be physically violent, not to steal, not to engage in sexual activity with each other, to be celibate on the retreat, and not to lie, and not to engage in the recreational use of intoxicants and drugs, and no alcohol. And this is not an easy thing to find in our society. Many places you go and you don't have that as a commitment by a group of people. And we do that not only because we're offering that as a gift to the community we live with, but we also do it as a way of protecting ourselves. Because to violate those precepts is a way of harming ourselves or closing down something's in us that goes against the grain. You're trying to go one direction, and then you want to go one direction, then you walk the other direction. So that's kind of inefficient. And the precepts are here to protect what's most wonderful, sincere, beautiful, profound, valuable in you. And to be in a community of people that share that is what we ask you to do. And if you do that, live by the precepts, you'll be supported. You'll benefit from that. You'll be practiced by it. The Dharma is always practicing you. It's not just a one-way thing that you practice the Dharma, but it's, trust me, the Dharma knows better than you what you need. So you might want to pay attention to what comes as you practice. So we'll chant the refuges and together and chant the precepts. We'll do the refuges in Pali. I will do call and response the first time we do it. And then the second and third time, if you would like to join me, partly because they represent the idea we're all in here together. You can join me. And if you've never heard this before, you get full credit for humming along. But first what we do is we do salutation to the Buddha. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. That's the salutation. And then we go through the refuges three times. And before the second time of each one, we go dutiyampi, which means for a second time. And then third time we say tatiyampi, which means for a third time. And the word for refuge is saranam. And so you'll hear that word. And going for refuge is literally means to walk, gacchami. And I love the idea it means walking, because when you walk someplace, you bring your whole self. So the idea, you bring your whole self into this. And then Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. So hopefully you can follow along. So as I do the first round, you can repeat after me. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddham saranam gacchami. Dhammam saranam gacchami. Sangham saranam gacchami. You can join me. Dutiyampi Buddham saranam gacchami. Dutiyampi Dhammam saranam gacchami. Dutiyampi Sangham saranam gacchami. Tatiyampi Buddham saranam gacchami. Tatiyampi Dhammam saranam gacchami. Tatiyampi Sangham saranam gacchami. And then we'll do the precepts in English, and I'll do half the phrase, and you can repeat, and I'll do the second half. For the sake of our practice together, I vow not to take life.
I vow not to take life.
For the sake of our practice together,
for the sake of our practice together,
I vow not to take what is not given.
I vow not to take what is not given.
For the sake of our practice together,
for the sake of our practice together,
I vow not to engage in sexual misconduct.
I vow not to engage in sexual misconduct.
For the sake of our practice together, I vow not to lie.
I vow not to lie.
For the sake of our practice together,
for the sake of our practice together,
I vow not to engage in intoxicants.
I vow not to engage in intoxicants.
And with the fruit that comes with the refuges and the precepts, may the fruit and the merit of that, the benefit that we attain, may it be for our welfare. for us as individuals, for us as a community, and for the wider community that we live in this world. That as we practice for this week, we don't practice only for our own sake. We practice for those, for the sake of those we practice with, and we practice for the sake of the whole world. May it be that our practice this week is for the welfare and happiness for the whole world, lessening the suffering of others.